I'm so glad you could do this. I really appreciate it. It's, you know, one of these new initiatives we're doing with Signs to continue to sort of reach out more broadly, to get folks engaged with the journal and get new audiences and raise sort of broader political issues. And so we're really thrilled you could do this.
Yeah, I think it's great that you're doing it. I really love the concept, so I'm happy to participate.
Well, thank you. So let's jump right in. I thought what would be the best is if we could start talking a little bit from the general to the more particular.
Sure.
If I could ask you some more general questions and then move into what I know we're going to both want to get into, which is to talk about what's going on right now.
Right.
And the Hillary situation. But if one of the questions that has really, you know, occupied your work and I think occupies a lot of us who are thinking about this is the question of why it has taken so long to have a viable woman candidate for president and what you think might be the main impediments to this. Are there, is it just or only a kind of misogyny and sexism? Is it pipeline issues in terms of women in government? Are there double standards? I mean, what are the constituents that make, you know, every time we think about it, I think, my God, I can't believe it's still taken this long, and yet it has. So how do you understand that?
Well, I think it's a little bit of many different things. I think all the things that you mentioned definitely contribute. Probably the main factor is we've just had so few women governors and senators, and virtually all our presidents, certainly all our recent presidents, have come from the ranks of governors and senators. You know, even today we only have 6 women governors and 20 women senators, and for the senators, that's we've had a substantial recent increase. So. So there aren't many women to choose from when you look at it from that perspective. So really, it is a pipeline issue in the sense that we've got to get more women into office at all levels, and you know, and we particularly need more women in these executive positions in government at the state level and in the U.S. Senate and House as well. So definitely the pipeline's a problem, but you know, what lies behind the pipeline problem and all the things I think that you mentioned are issues. You know, certainly if you watched what Hillary Clinton went through in 2008, I think most women would be kind of reluctant to put themselves forward. It really takes an amazing person to be able to withstand the kind of public scrutiny, not just of yourself, but of your family, and those close to you. I think that's a major reservation for a lot of people, women in particular, but people in general, that things will be dragged up, you know, things that you did when you were 20, right. You know, I mean, statements you made when you were 20, and that, you know, you really have to be very tough skinned.
Why would you imagine that, you know, that dredging up and that kind of a focus and interrogation would affect women more?
I don't know that it affects, I don't know that it affects them personally more. In other words, I think there are a lot of women who could withstand it, but I mean, women are still more relational, you know, and even in the way they make these decisions to run for office. I mean, one of the research that I've done with a colleague at the Center for American Women in Politics, Kira Sambamatsu, we have found that, you know, women are more relational in the way they make their decisions to run for office. They're more likely to need encouragement. You know, they don't necessarily run till other people come to them. Most women don't run till other people come to them and encourage them to do so. As we always say at the center, you know, women don't get up in the morning, look in the mirror as many men do and say, oh, I think I see the next governor of the state. yeah. You know, that just doesn't happen very often with women. And they also make those decisions very much in the context of, you know, their family. Women are older when they run for office. You know, they wait until their children are grown. You know, they virtually never run for office without, unless their spouses, if they have spouses, are fully supportive, or, you know, their partners are fully supportive. So, you find more variation among men. I'm not saying that these aren't factors for men as well. And increasingly, I think as women have come into politics, men have started paying more attention, and at least talking more about family considerations in the way they make decisions. But I think it's the scrutiny of, you know, the other people in their lives that they worry even more about. And then there are barriers out there that are real. The financial barriers. If you talk to women in politics and interview them, as I've done with many, they will say that two of the main things in terms, and including women who were recruiting women to run for office, two of the main things are, first of all, these considerations about their families and waiting till their family responsibilities are largely over and they have more independence. As I always say, maybe we should be trying to recruit women to think about politics as a second career or a third career, you know, rather than trying to go after just young women. I mean, maybe that's the point at which most women are able really to think about it and do it. But of course we need women of all ages actually, running for office. But the family considerations are one of the major things that come up. And the other thing that comes up is the issue of money, you know, how expensive it is to run for most levels of office. Although there's enormous variation across the country, but certainly these high levels of office, very, very expensive. And the fact that, you know, most women don't like the idea of fundraising. And even though there's certainly research for women who are running for Congress that shows that women are able to raise just as much money as men do. And largely that's because, I think, on the Democratic side, because of the equalizing effect of Emily's List, which is a PAC that funds pro-choice Democratic women and has really leveled the playing field for Democratic women at the congressional level when it comes to fundraising. But at other levels of office, it's less clear that, you know, there's the women receive that anything close to that kind of support. And women claim that they have to raise money, that it's harder for them to raise money. And they claim that it's, and maybe that's because they raise it more often in smaller donations. Women are less likely to write big checks than men. Women often rely more on women than men do as potential donors. So part of it is about, you know, the size of the donations and how hard they have to work to raise the money. So they may end up raising the same amount of money in the end, but, you know, they may have to put more effort into it, more of their effort, more of their campaign staff's effort and energy. So fundraising is at least perceived by women out there as definitely a major obstacle. So I think those are some of the main things. I think that what they don't worry about are the voters. You know, I think that, you know, there is good social science evidence that suggests that voters are not the main problem for women candidates, really, even though there are voters out there who you know, all things being equal, wouldn't vote for a woman candidate. Right. But there also are voters out there now who, all things being equal, would vote for a woman candidate. Right.
And let me stay on this for a minute, because one of the things, you know, and I think you're absolutely right. I mean, this pipeline issue is clearly a critical issue all the way down the line. And I wonder what you might see as some of the best practices that have been used to encourage more and more women to get into that pipeline so that we see women at higher levels vying for office. What are some of the models out there? I mean, besides something like Emily's List, which has been so enormously successful, what else has been out there that has really tried to rectify this pipeline problem?
Well, I'll do a little self-promotion here for the Center for American Women in Politics, because we have a couple of programs that are very much aimed at this in different kinds of ways. One of them is something we call ready to run, which is basically, you know, campaign training for women candidates. And it's a program we started here in New Jersey. We do special, we do a general program for women, for all women, but we also do very specialized portions of this program for Asian American women, Latinas, and African American women, where women from that community really design their own programs because they're at different places in terms of their politicization and what they perceive as needed. And it's designed both to, we have sort of two phases with it. It's both for women who, are ready to think about running for office, and then also for women who are just sort of maybe not thinking they want to run themselves, but might want to help someone else or get involved in some way. So we have this program that we run every year, and we have now cloned this in, I don't know the exact number, but somewhere around 15 to 20 states throughout the country where we have found, partners, in those states. So this encourages women. It's a networking opportunity for political women to come together. I mean, in our state, it's just become sort of a big annual event. And so we get a lot of political women showing up, and it is a great networking, opportunity. And it does provide kind of support and encouragement for women, which I think is absolutely critical. And the research suggests that as well. You know, so that's one kind of program. Another kind of program that we run, and we've also cloned, gone into many states, several states, about the same number, really, and found partnered with other institutions to do similar programs, is a program we call New Leadership. And it's really aimed at college-age women, where we bring women from different campuses, college campuses in the state, together for about 10 days in the summer and expose them to political women as role models. I mean, not just political women who are office holders, but also activists, public policy advocates, to try to get them really, really interested, in becoming active in political life in whichever way they choose, those women too, they may not run for office, right away or even ultimately, but further down the road, and maybe their lives are a little too crowded, too busy at the moment to pursue some of this, but it does politicize them in a way that further down the road, they do get involved. They get involved immediately in some ways. And my guess is that over time their involvement increases as well. So that's, so those are a couple examples of ways. I mean, it's a long-term project. It's not something that's going to happen.
Well, I know. I was just going to comment on that because it's always striking to me, when you sort of look at the history of U.S. feminism and sort of some of the enormous changes in all kinds of arenas of social life and sexual life and intimate life and family life. And then when it comes to electoral politics, it just the numbers seem so teeny and so incremental. And so I wonder what you think are sort of the long-term prospects for shifting that, because it does seem like for whatever set of reasons, that remains a recalcitrant holdout in sheer numbers in terms of women in public office, and certainly comparatively internationally. So what do you see as the prospects for shifting that, and how do you understand that the difference in the ways in which feminism has impacted other areas of life and yet not impacted electoral politics in a similar way?
Well, I think our political system has a lot to do with it, in the sense that the founding fathers designed a political system that was sort of biased against rapid change, I guess I would say, insurgency, and so and that's continued over time, so that and even become even more so in some ways, I think. So we have a two-party system. Most other countries have multi-party systems. We have a single pass to post system. There are things that are built into our political system that make turnover make it more difficult. There aren't as many political opportunities. That the turnover is much slower. You know, for Congress, people get into Congress and they, I mean, you literally see it. They get reelected and reelected and reelected. A lot of that has to do with the redistricting process, which happens after every census every 10 years. And, you know, and it's really led to the kind of gridlock that we're seeing in Congress now, because, it's controlled by the states.
Right.
It's a political process. Each state does it differently. So it's very, you know, there's not a centralized way of doing it, but it's highly politicized in most states. And the state that the party that's in control, which at this point in the vast majority of state legislatures in this country is the Republican Party. The party that's in control tends to, use that system in such a way as to benefit their party and create a lot of safe districts for members of their party. And, you know, and that's actually happened on both sides. So now you have most members of Congress are from districts where they really don't face serious electoral competition.
Right.
And if they do, it's in the primaries. I mean, what Republicans are now worried about more than facing Democratic opponents is something they call being primaried. You know, they're worried about challenges from people on the right who will come into their primary because their districts are so conservative. This has been a real problem for Republican women, by the way, you know, and why the numbers of Republican women have been basically flatlining in state legislatures and, you know, and pretty much in Congress. They've not been going up very much at all, if at all. And part of it is because, you know, there is this problem of, you know, someone coming from the right and the creation of these districts that are so incredibly conservative. And a lot of the Republican women historically who served in Congress, if you go back to the 70s and 80s, there were almost equal numbers of Democrats and Republican women in Congress. And that's no longer the case. It's 2-1 Democrats now. Part of the problem is we've lost a lot of the moderate Republican women because the districts have been created to be so conservative now, you know, and a lot of the moderate Republican women have just been squeezed out. So there's been you know, when we look at the problem of the women not increasing in numbers in office in this country or not increasing very quickly. There really are two trend lines. You know, for Democratic women, the trajectory has continued to go upward, slowly, but upward. And actually, a lot of that has to do, certainly at the congressional level, with the election of women of color. You know, I mean, Black women in particular, but women of color generally, there's been an increase. And a lot of the increase in the Democratic numbers are really due to women of color and to some of the redistricting, you know, the civil rights redistricting that took place, which also created safe districts. And the Republicans took advantage then and created Republican, you know, put all the sort of African-Americans in one district and then created made very conservative counterpart districts.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's obviously a part of that, I would think, is that, you know, the phenomenon of the moderate Republican is like the dinosaur at this point. You know,
yes.
I mean, it really is almost no such thing left
yes.
of what used to be known as Rockefeller Republicans, or, you know, that just is become a party so much of the far right. And of course, this election season is seeing that come to full fruition.
That's very true.
Yeah. I would love to, I mean, now to get a bit to obviously the current situation. And, you know, given all of this and given the question, you know, this sort of delay in real transformative growth of women in public office at all levels, what do you think, in your opinion, in the sort of broadest kind of sense, would be the impact, both, I would say, both nationally and internationally, of having a female president? On American politics and culture, and again, on an international scale as well. I mean, given this long history of not only not having a woman president, but of course, not even having anywhere near equal numbers of women in any realm of public office, what do you think would be the key effects of an election of, say, Hillary Clinton at this point?
Well, in terms of the world, I think it would be a signal that the U.S. has finally come into the 21st century. you know, that we finally caught up with so many other countries in the world who have had women heads of state. It's not an uncommon thing worldwide to have a woman head of state, but we've really lagged behind a lot of other countries. And even in terms of our national legislature, there's the Parliamentary Union puts out a list of comparing the United States to other countries, or, you know, puts out a list of all countries and the United States on the list. And there are more than 100 countries ahead of us in terms of representation of women in the national legislature.
Right.
So we are far behind. So, it would be a sign that we're, you know, finally joining, you know, the rest of the world in terms of women in top positions in our government. In terms of the U.S., I think it would really help to normalize the idea of having women in high level political positions. I think it's very similar to what Barack Obama, the election of Barack Obama, has done in terms of normalizing the idea of having African Americans or people of color run for top level office. I think some evidence of that. We're certainly not in a post-racial society, and there certainly are enormous barriers out there for people of color seeking elective office as well. But it was interesting to me that when Ben Carson ran for the Republican nomination this year, virtually no one commented on his race. And he had quite a lot of support, surprisingly so much support, I think, from a pretty conservative base. So I think Barack Obama's helped to kind of it's not jarring. It's not shocking to see, a black person running for a top level office now. And I think having a woman run would do a similar kind of thing. It wouldn't be anything remarkable. And I think that's where we want to get to. We're having women run for top level offices isn't anything to particularly remark right. upon or notice. I think it also would very much open doors for women at other levels of office. As I think I mentioned earlier, we only have six women governors. Executive office has been very tough for women. People have more readily elected women as representatives than as executives. So you see greater representation of women in legislative positions than in executive positions. So we currently only have six women governors. We've only had 37 in the entire history of our country. I mean, we have 50 states. Yeah. We've only had 37 women governors. In cities over 30,000, fewer than one-fifth, one out of every five mayors is a woman. So fewer than one-fifth of all the mayors are women.
Right.
So we need the doors to open and for it to become more normal. I really think that once, there are still people in this country who haven't had the opportunity to vote for a woman for a high, for high levels of office, yeah. whether it be Congress or the presidency or I guess those are the national office for sure. And maybe other levels of office as well. And I think once it becomes more normal, once that becomes more common, then it becomes, the doors open, it becomes more normal.
Right.
And I think it will, and it'll pave the way for, I think also Hillary Clinton, the election of Hillary Clinton would actually pave the way for, of course, some of it depends, because the first woman always becomes, all other women get judged by the first woman. So if she's a disaster as president, you know, it could cause a problem for other women. But assuming that she proves to be a competent president, I think it opens the door and lets lots, you know, more kinds of other women through. I mean, that's what we see in, you know, certainly what we've seen in other kinds of, arenas in society.
Well, I was just going to follow up on that, because I agree with that on a sort of intuitive and symbolic level. But one of the things I was just wondering is, you know, if there has been, and if you have found in any of your research, any real data or evidence that having women in these positions of political power has an impact, not just on women and girls feeling an ability to enter into public office and to compete for that, but more generally on women and girls' sense of well-being, life chances, and so on.
Wow, you know, that's such a hard thing to research.
Right. It is, I know.
I don't know a good research on that. I mean, maybe it's been done, but I think that's a very difficult, you know, that's a very, even just trying to research whether it affects the aspirations or the way girls see the world is difficult, and then to see if it really has a difference on there. You know, I mean, you can look at public policy. You can look at something like Title IX, for example, you know, which women were in the 70s in Congress were very much instrumental. I mean, you know, Patsy Ming,
right?
You know, I mean, you can point to pieces of legislation where their lives have certainly changed because of what women in office have done. You can definitely do that. But systematic research that would show kind of that on a broader scale is hard to imagine how even to design it.
I know. It's an interesting question, because, of course, we all believe that. We believe that, of course, you know, opening up, you know, seeing these both as role models and as competent and as sort of breaking glass ceilings, however you want to describe it, that does actually change the everyday life in some structural sense for women and girls. But it is hard to sort of think of how one actually could measure that or quantify it in some way.
Well, we've certainly done research at the Center for American Women in Politics that looks at, and other scholars have done this as well, which looks at whether women who were in office, you know, have more of a commitment to certain kinds of policy issues, whether they, you know, whether they're more concerned, whether they give priority to different issues, whether they co-sponsor different kinds of legislation. And certainly there's evidence that they do, you know, that they bring, you know, that they're more attentive to the impact of policy generally.
Right.
You know, they're more likely to think about how women's and children's lives will be affected by legislation. There's evidence of that. There's evidence that they give greater priority to not only, you know, the issues that we think of as part of the feminist agenda, but also, you know, to sort of more traditional issues associated with women, like healthcare and education, that those tend to be, you know, greater priority for them. You know, so there's certainly research that suggests that women office holders have that kind of a commitment. Of course, you know, when you talk with women on the right and women on the left, the way they pursue those commitments is somewhat different, right? So, Republican women might prefer in some cases something like tax cuts, whereas, you know, to pursue a policy, whereas, you know, Democratic women might have, say, childcare. You know, Republican women would be more in favor of tax cuts. You know, Democratic women would be more in favor of, you know, government provided provision or more direct government role in the provision. But, you know, so they might differ in their strategies, but nevertheless, the priorities tend to be there. And they do. So there's evidence, you know, there are different pieces of evidence, but not the overall kind
of
comprehensive study. Yeah.
So can we turn a little bit to the elephant in the room here, which of course is Hillary. and this obviously,
well, she's a donkey, actually,
donkey but... in the room, right? But this, you know, this amazing moment that we're in here. And let me start with the, sort of the biggest question of this, which is the question of this outsized Hillary demonization. That certainly comes as been a long time on the right wing. If she is the nominee, of course, we can imagine what it's going to look like, as we saw some of it already. But it also is appearing in some quite troubling ways on the left, I think in ways that we hadn't perhaps anticipated or seen in the past. But the kind of over-the-top demonization of this particular candidate begs for some kind of explanation. It seems so out of whack with any representation of her as a sort of living, breathing human being and her own history. How do you understand the outsized level of this demonization of Hillary Clinton?
I think there are a number of contributing factors. You know, one is that she's been in public life for 35 years. So there's been a lot of opportunity for people to go after her, and her husband's been president. So there was a lot of opportunity for them to go after him. And you know, and she gets held accountable for his actions in a way that I find sort of problematic. But, you know, so part of it was, I mean, there's still the right. Certainly was, the right certainly went after the Clintons while he was president in a fairly aggressive way. I mean, things like, you know, and Hillary Clinton, like, they didn't like the fact that, you know, she didn't conform as first lady, at least initially. She really didn't conform to the standards of the time. She talked about how she could have stayed home and baked cookies, but instead she pursued a profession that didn't go over well. Right. She headed up the President Bill Clinton's task force on healthcare, which she now talks about. That really didn't go over well with the right. They came after her pretty viciously on that. They held her responsible for Vince Foster's suicide, said that she was having, there was all this stuff about how she was having an affair with Vince Foster. And, you know, I mean, the tragedy of his death, they pointed to her as somehow responsible. I mean, it was just lots of stuff like that. So it started, it's had many years to fester. The media also seems not to like Hillary Clinton very much in general. And some of that I think has been that she's not been as accessible as they would like her to be. And again, I think a lot of that is tied to the way she's been, the things she's had to go through over time and the way they've played out in the media. And she's just become, I think, more guarded, certainly more guarded than Donald Trump, but more guarded, as a result of that. And so there are a lot of, she gets pretty rough treatment in the media, as well at times. And certainly, and I think it's just a sign, the way she's been treated too is just a sign that really it's a sign that sexism is far from eradicated in the society. I mean, she is the first woman to run for this level of office. So we don't really know if it had been another woman with very different characteristics, if we would have seen the same manifestations or, that woman would have been treated just as harshly, you know, in some ways as Hillary Clinton has been treated. I know that back when she first ran in 2008, I was actually stunned by the level of, you know, sexism directed at her.
Right. So was I. I remember it well.
Yeah. I just didn't, I was unprepared for it in a way. I thought, you know, I thought she was so well known that, and that we were, you know, somehow past some of this stuff, but the vitriol that was directed against her on the internet and elsewhere. But, you know, so you had you know, the Hillary Clinton nutcrackers, you know, you had Tucker Carlson on cable television. More than once I saw him say this, that, you know, he said basically when Hillary Clinton comes on television, I involuntarily cross my legs.
Right.
She was repeatedly characterized as a bitch. So you had, you know, to the point where Tina Fey on Saturday Night Live famously, you know, proclaimed that bitches get stuff done and referred to bitches the new black. You know, you had the New York Times had an article, a full in the national news section. Now, this was really surprising me. A full length article in the national news section devoted to analysis of Hillary Clinton's cackle. Right. You know, the way she laughed, was it genuine or was it somehow calculated? You know, it just went on and on and on. And this time, I think we're not seeing as much overt stuff so far, you know, at the same level, although there is this. There is this discussion of her tone, you know, right. which is just outrageous that somehow, you know, Bernie Sanders is up there, you know, I mean, he screams constantly. You know, it's his style of speaking. He gets in front of a big crowd and he's just carrying on and screaming and he doesn't smile very much. And they don't comment on that, but the media commentators, you know, there have been several. This has come up more than once recently, where there's been suggestions that Hillary Clinton needs to modulate better.
Right.
She's too shrill. She needs to watch her tone. She shouldn't yell, and she doesn't yell very much. But you know, if she raises her voice, it becomes, you know, she becomes shrill and that she needs to smile more often.
Right.
You know, so we are seeing some of these things. It's not quite at the level, I think,
but those double standards are still so clearly there. I mean, I wonder if you think how she has, you know, given that she went through all that once, how has she changed her sort of strategy around thinking around her gender presentation, her identification as a feminist, and her experiences, learning from her experiences of being so demonized first time around. How do you think she's handled it, or has she, differently this time?
Well, I think she's trying to show more humor. I think she's trying to show more, you know, to be more personable and reflective than she was the last time. I mean, part of it was in 2008. In 2008, she had her chief strategist was a guy named Mark Penn,
right.
who felt that her major problems were that she needed to be able to prove that she was tough enough to be commander in chief, and that she needed to prove that she was experienced. And for good, there was some good reason for that. I mean, there's research that shows that these are major stereotypes that voters have when it comes to women candidates, that they're, you know, they're not tough enough. They have questions about whether women can be tough enough, particularly in executive positions. And also, even when women are more experienced, well, they have to be more experienced to be seen as equally experienced, basically. So even when women are experienced, men are assumed to be experienced, even when they're not. And with women, you know, the experience issue is always a question. You know, is she qualified? Is she really experienced? So there's, you know, and there's good research to suggest that to back him up on this. But the whole campaign became about establishing her toughness and her experience. She made no appeals basically throughout the entire campaign to and no references to really to being a woman. She didn't talk about being a woman.
Yeah,
until
I find that very interesting.
Final speech.
Right. Yeah. I mean, until that you know, the cracks in the ceiling speech. Yeah.
Right.
It does seem to me one of the things she's doing now,
yes,
which has been very interesting, has been to sort of not only configure herself or cite herself or reference herself as a woman, but also to really reference herself as a feminist and
sort of
centralize herself as a feminist candidate running in ways that, of course, is very heartening to see. But also, I think it'll be interesting to see how that actually will play out, both in the primaries and in the general election.
She's definitely positioning herself more as a, you know, in terms of appealing to women voters. There's no question about that. Yes, and she is talking about feminist issues and pursuing some feminist issues. She's definitely strong on, you know, on the issue of women's reproductive rights and choice. She's definitely strong on pay equity issues. In part, that's because polls have shown, you know, that those issues are more popular with certainly with her base, but also with even with voters in the middle who might vote for her, women who might vote for her. So I think she's trying to, you know, she got the message of the last election, which is that she didn't do enough of that. And this time she's much more running, you know, as a woman, and initially was running, talking a lot about the historical nature of her candidacy. Seemingly a little less of that this time, but definitely the you know, the being a woman, and there are good reasons, because women voters are supporting her in much greater proportions than men, even within the Democratic primary.
Although there is, you know,
the gap is sizable.
There is this gap that I wonder if you could comment on about Hillary's. Hillary seems to have much stronger support among older women. And
yes.
Then Bernie much stronger among younger women, so that the gender breaks down around age there. How do you understand that?
Well, you know, I think it really has to do with something that I very much admire among the millennial generation, which is that they have come, you know, they have a much greater tolerance and acceptance of diversity and difference, I think, than older generations. Identity differences mean less to them. They just don't make as much of it. They're more accepting of an array of people. That's a great thing. But I think that the flip side of that is that, therefore, the notion of a woman candidate means less to them than it means to, you know, older generations of women. The fact that a candidate is a woman. They don't see the barriers. I think they don't see, you know, they don't see the barriers the same way that that older generations of women who have lived through those barriers see them. And so, I think that's part of it. I also think that, young folks, the younger folks, I think, are very attracted to the idea of being part of a movement, being part of something bigger. And Bernie Sanders definitely offers that. I mean, Hillary Clinton tends to talk in terms, she's tried to change this recently, but she still doesn't. She talks more in terms of, you know, I will do this, or,
right,
you know,
right.
And Bernie talks more in terms of, we will do, you know, we, you know, his, it's more of a movement kind of position, the big rallies, I actually think Hillary Clinton needs to adopt a little more of that, as she moves in, you know, if she becomes the candidate, moves into the nominee and moves into the general election, a little more of the kind of, making younger people feel part of something bigger. And then of course there's also there is the kind of material side of it, which is, you know, Bernie Sanders is offering, you know, the aspirational side, I guess you might say, which is Bernie Sanders is saying, you know, I'm going to give you, you know, I'm going to make public education free. I'm going to make healthcare free, so I think that's very attractive. Whereas Hillary Clinton isn't going to go there, because she knows she can't really come through with those things. She doesn't want to run on those positions in a general election.
Let me go back to the question of the generational, because it is so, you know, there really is such a generation. I mean, there is this huge gender difference in terms of the GOP and the Democrats, and then there's this generational difference within the Democrats. And one of the things I certainly have heard a lot from younger women is, and it's precisely what you were talking about, is this reluctance to make a case that voting for a woman, qua woman, has any merit in and of itself. And, you know, that there's something, there's almost an embarrassment to say that. So that this, you know, this idea that if I were to say, I do want to see a woman elected, I am, part of the reason I'm supporting Hillary is because she's a woman, that is, I think, looked upon as a kind of relic of an identity politics that we should have surpassed by now. What's always interesting to me in that is that I actually think that doesn't play out in quite the same way around race in our society. So I think, you know, with the election of Obama, I think people felt very free to say, you know, this is this historic moment. I want to support an African American running for office. You know, the having an African American in office is significant. It matters. It's meaningful. That is part of the reason I'm supporting him. And I think we're much more hesitant to do that around gender. And I wonder what you think. I mean, I've found this quite a bit across all generations talking about this. Why do you think that is? Why does it break down so differently?
That's a tough one. That's a tough one. I mean, I think that's a fair observation. I think it just has to do with the difference in the history and in the way that race and gender played out in our society. People are quicker in our society now, I think, at least in some circles, to call out racism than they are sexism. And it's part of the same kind of pattern. You can still say sexist things. Look at what they did in 2008 with Hillary Clinton and the media. There's no way that they would have said racist things like that. It wouldn't have been acceptable. So, you know,
of course, that's changing with this election, with Trump saying some of the most explicitly racist things imaginable.
Well, that's true. Trump is getting by with some things that no one else seems to be able to get by with. But the media per se wouldn't be doing it.
Right.
The media would not be doing it, as though it's somehow objective, part of objective reporting. There just is this difference. What I see is that I also see a lot of people who say, well, I would vote for a woman, but Hillary Clinton's not the woman, right? You know, I vote for a woman candidate if she were the right candidate. My response to that is if people are going to wait around for the perfect woman candidate, they're never going to be voting for a woman. Perfect is the enemy of good. And, you know, all candidates are going to be flawed. And if you could design the perfect woman candidate, you know, Hillary Clinton wouldn't be my perfect woman candidate. She wouldn't be probably your perfect woman candidate.
Absolutely,
and she wouldn't
true,
be
right?
the perfect woman candidate of anybody who, you know, hears our discussion or reads our discussion. So,
right.
So I think there's also this more so with women. I do think there's a gender component to this, that women want to hold women to a very tough standard, a very high standard that they want women to be, and maybe because we have so much at stake, you know, because
well, yeah, I because think that's true. I mean, I also think
if a woman fails, we all are going to be judged by it. So, right. So maybe we have more, you know, maybe there's more at stake, but there is also this kind of holding out for a woman who's better, you know, for a
well,
woman who
I think that's part of
really
it. I
represents
think,
me.
I mean, one of the things I've often heard too, is that I think there is this fear of being tarred with the brush of a kind of essentialism. So, you know, this
yes.
idea that, you know, you're, I mean, certainly for those of us who have written about Hillary and been in any of the public debates about any of this, you know, I haven't had one moment where I haven't, well, Susanna, you must be thinking with your vagina, you know,
yeah.
you're voting with your gender, you're, you know, and of course, That is, you know, immediately disenfranchises you and immediately dismisses any argument and puts you in a category of being not a serious thinker about these issues. And so I do think that it's been, you know, it's an interesting phenomenon I've seen happening and again and again. And of course, the double standard for that remains patent. I mean, no one seems to be asking supporters of Bernie or of Cruz or of Obama, you know, whether they're voting with their gender.
Exactly.
Right? So we only ask the question of voting with your gender, voting with your genitals. Certainly that's been used even. You know, to women who are supporting women candidates.
And, you know, and for me, it's a fair consideration to think about. I mean, we factor many things into our voting decisions. You know, we always factor, you know, personal characteristics into voting decisions. Even people who say they don't, they do. You know, we make an assessment about, you know, someone's leadership capacity. The American public, you know, likes people to be, they like their candidates for the most part to be likable. You know, it's somebody they want to have a beer with. You know, so it's not, you know, it's not uncommon to factor in. And no one, I mean, if this were Sarah Palin,
of course,
you know, the people who are supporting Hillary Clinton wouldn't be supporting Sarah Palin. I mean, it just wouldn't happen. So this isn't just about gender. It's just that gender is one of the many considerations that go in. And it virtually never, I mean, there's very little evidence that gender trumps party or ideology.
Well, but of course, but it's not only that, of course, gender and race, of course, are only brought up when it has to do with women or people of color. So, you know, one of the things that's interesting about the Trump candidacy now and what's going on with that is that actually for the first time, people are really talking about a kind of virulent and ugly white masculinity.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and actually, I mean, if there's any upside of what's going on with that, and I don't think there's much, but if there's any upside is that we actually, the lens of gender is for once being trained on a man and a male candidate instead of only around questions of female candidates.
That's true. All of the objectification of women that's taking place on that side is really quite something. You know, it's astounding, actually.
Well,
it's astounding.
Let me just follow up and then ask you something about that. Do you think there's any, in a sort of a historical sense, any relationship in this particular bizarre political moment of having a viable woman candidate for the first time and on the other side of the fence, having this, you know, virulently misogynist candidate? I mean, is this, you know, the moment of Trump and Hillary, is this just a coincidence? Is the Trump candidacy in some ways part of that long backlash that Susan Faludi still wrote about and that still is with us? Is that part of what is motivating this?
I don't think Trump, maybe some of the stuff he's doing around gender is in some way an attempt to appeal to people who he wants to shore up, who might otherwise think about Hillary Clinton. I think when we get into a general election, we may see that in the competition for like white working class males, for example.
Right.
You know, black voters are incredibly solidly in Hillary Clinton's camp, and that includes, for the most part, young black voters as well. There is some generational difference, but they're still breaking for Clinton, and you know, and black women are just the base for Clinton. I mean, they really are. They're just her, you know. Black women vote at the highest rate of any. I don't think a lot of people know this, but black women actually vote at the highest rate of any racial gender group. In other words, they vote at a higher rate than white women, and white women outvote white men. So,
So let me follow up on that, because that's such, I think that's so important. You said that. I did know that, and it's an incredible piece of information. And I wonder then if what we'll see is a Clinton Trump, if that's going to be what the contest will be. How do you imagine her strategy will be to broaden the gender gap that would be even more profoundly present, I think, with a Trump candidacy? What do you imagine her strategy will be? And in terms of that, how do you imagine she might reckon with and respond to the kind of misogyny that's going to come at her from a Trump candidate?
Oh, those are tough. Let's see. I actually think she will not try to maximize the gender gap. I don't think she'll have to. I think she'll just let Trump do it for her. because he says, he just keeps saying things that will offend a lot of women. So I think she can be somewhat passive. I think she pursues her campaign strategy and she does what she's doing now. And she talks about, pay equity, and she talks about, she talks about abortion and reproductive rights and contraception and issues that will appeal to women in addition to, her general issues. But I don't think she, specific issues that might appeal to women. But right. I don't think it would her strategy would change that much. How she's going to deal with Trump. I they'd have to pay me a lot of money to be able to come up with the answer to that. I don't think her people know how to do that. So,
it is the question. I think none of us, I sort of can figure how Bernie would push back against Trump, but it's hard to quite know because what will be so patently obvious, I think, is how Trump will play this as a kind of bully and, he will, use a kind of sexist.
And he'll probably get away with it.
Yes.
Based on what we've seen. Yeah. That's the thing. Like Rick Lazio, when he ran against Clinton in the U.S. Senate race in New York, went over and shook his finger at her. And it backfired tremendously on him.
Right.
He pointed his finger at her. Trump doing that would only probably help Trump.
Right.
The same rules don't seem to apply. To his behavior. People expect him to be outrageous, and expect him to be a bully. And so, it doesn't seem to have the same consequences. It's part of his MO. So,
right.
I don't know. I think it's a bit of a wild card to know how you run against someone like that. I do think there'll be some part of the challenge, I think, against running against Trump it's going to be interesting to see how Clinton tries to pursue. One of the target groups for her is going to have to be kind of, white working class men. Not that she needs to, she's never going to win them over, but she needs to do not terribly with them. And the last election in 2008, she did pretty well in the primaries with that particular group. But Trump has particular appeal there. So, and that's maybe where, she may choose a vice presidential candidate who will, hopefully help her with that.
Well, I was just gonna end with asking you any prognostications on what you imagine her ticket mate might be. Do you think of a Hillary Bernie pairing is
absolutely not?
No.
Not a chance.
Oh, so many of us would love to see it, but yes, I think you're probably right. What do you think?
It's hard to know because I think they'll make the decision based on, they're going to make the decision. Most campaigns make that decision based on what they think they need for the campaign at that time. I would think she would go one of two directions. Either she picks somebody who can help go after those labor guys, labor union guys, and try to peel off some of them from, in the way that Biden would have had that kind of an appeal, perhaps. She's not going to pick Biden, but would have had that kind of appeal. And the person I would point to as a possibility there is Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown, who's quite, he's sort of Elizabeth Warren he's very much like Elizabeth Warren in his politics, actually.
Right.
So I think it would help to keep the Democratic left, part of the base happier, a little bit happy.
Right.
And he's very sort of pro-union, anti-trade. And most importantly, he comes from Ohio, and he's popular in Ohio. And a Republican has never won in recent history. A Republican has never won the presidency without carrying Ohio. You know, so I think the fact that he's from Ohio makes him very, very attractive as a potential vice.